Experts say there's a childcare crisis in Ohio. There's not enough affordable, high-quality childcare options for would-be workers. And if workers can't find childcare, they'll get out of the workforce altogether. Many believe this must be addressed if the region and Ohio wants to keep jobs filled. It's a concern raised by the president of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, along with policy and childcare experts. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Today, we'll talk to representatives from the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, Starting Point, Policy Matters Ohio, and with a childcare provider on what needs to be done. Later, a conversation with population demographer Jennifer Shuba about her new book, 8 Billion and Counting, which asks the question, how can we use the 8 billion people we have on the planet today to shape the world we want tomorrow? Those conversations coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. The lack of affordable and accessible childcare in Ohio is not only hurting families, but also our greater economy by forcing parents and guardians to leave the workforce. That's according to childcare advocates, policy experts, and business associations like the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. A new Policy Matters Ohio report says that while childcare is vital to millions of families in the state, it is simply unaffordable for most Ohioans, where the average annual cost for one infant's childcare is more than $9,600, or more than $800 a month. It would take two parents a combined income of almost $140,000 to be able to afford that for just one child, or put another way, each parent would have to make $33 an hour. And childcare centers, they say they are still recovering from the pandemic, with many struggling to get back to pre-COVID capacity and having trouble finding qualified workers at the level of pay they can afford. The Policy Matters report found that 39% of Ohioans live in a childcare desert, which are most prevalent in rural areas. Different organizations are now drawing attention to this crisis through the lens of what this means for our economy by having public conversations. One's happening tomorrow night in Cleveland from Starting Point and Collaborate Cleveland. They'll discuss the issue in a public officials forum for Greater Cleveland leaders. Then next Tuesday, the Ohio Chamber of Commerce is hosting a childcare summit in Columbus. This hour, we're going to talk for a while about the state of childcare in Ohio and how it's impacting families, the economy, and the workforce. Joining me in studio for this conversation is Nancy Mendez, president and CEO of Starting Point, Northeast Ohio's early education resource and referral agency. Nancy, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. We also have Dave Smith, Executive Director of Horizon Education Centers, which is a nonprofit that operates 14 early childhood centers in the region and works with schools in before and after school programs. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with me by phone is Steve Stivers, President and CEO of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, who's also a former Republican congressman. Steve, good morning.
Good to be with you.
And finally, we have Catherine Poe, a budget and health researcher with Policy Matters Ohio and one of the authors of the report I just mentioned. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts or questions on the state of childcare in the region and in Ohio, or if you have a personal anecdote about trying to find childcare for your child, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Steve, you recently wrote an op-ed that caught our attention and have been pretty vocal about how the childcare crisis is impacting the workforce. Basically, workers need childcare options if they want to go to work. Why is this such a big problem for our economy?
Well, let me give you one stat that really highlights it. 70% of non-working or part-time working moms with children under five say they'd go back to work full-time if they had access to quality childcare at a reasonable cost. The number one thing we hear from our members, we have about 8,000 business members across Ohio in all industries, all regions, and all sizes of business. The number one thing we hear is they can't get enough people. Childcare and the lack of childcare is impacting the ability of businesses to get quality employees and the ability of, you know, two-parent households to send both parents to work. And you talked about the cost of childcare from the Policy Matters study. We published a blueprint for Ohio's economic future last year, and we compared rent costs to the cost of childcare. And childcare in Ohio costs 103% of rent. So people with children in childcare are paying more to their childcare than they are for a place to live. That's that really shows how unaffordable childcare is right now. You already talked about the childcare deserts, where there are 39% of Ohioans live someplace where even if they want childcare and are willing to pay those prices that are too high, they can't get access to it because there's not enough slots. So we've got some problems. I'm excited for Governor DeWine's State of the State speech today. I think he's going to make a couple of announcements, at least I'm hopeful he will, about childcare. And we are hopeful he'll do something to help childcare deserts. We are hopeful he'll do something to help childcare affordability. And then, of course, there's the workforce issue inside childcare as well, because of the lower wages that a lot of childcare providers pay because the reimbursements are too low. They can't afford to pay their people, and therefore they're having trouble getting childcare workers, which is one of the things driving the childcare deserts that we talked about. So it's a multifaceted problem. We are excited for the engagement we're seeing across the political spectrum and across a lot of institutions, people that are involved in the childcare industry, people that are in nonprofits and for-profit businesses are all working together with government officials to try to solve these problems.
Well,
so I do have hope.
Yeah, and Steve, even having your organization be a vocal one when it comes to the needs of parents and guardians and the childcare crisis, the business world now saying this is vital for our economy, that seems to be a new convergence of different organizations that are kind of saying the same thing when it comes to childcare.
That's 100% true. And I admit, when I came to the chamber in 2021 from Congress, I did not expect to be talking about issues like childcare and housing, but they're some of the top issues that are impacting business growth in Ohio. So that's why we're talking about them.
Catherine, the recent report you co-authored really lays out the crisis in more stark terms. The main point being that child care is really, as Steve mentioned, so expensive for most Ohioans. So why don't you lay out some of the findings?
Yeah, so I totally agree with Steve about the scope of how severe this crisis is and how it's impacting our workforce. You know, we really found that, you know, childcare is an everyone issue. We often think about this issue in association with, you know, parents and families, but this is really something that hits our economy at all levels, including our workforce. And so what my co-author Ali Smith and I did was we really took a look not only at the scope of the childcare crisis in Ohio, but we also did comparisons to other states to see how other states had kind of attempted to address this issue even since the pandemic. And what we found is that Ohio has the lowest eligibility for publicly funded childcare in the country for kids ages 0 to 5. We also found that from 2017 to 2022, the number of childcare workers in Ohio dropped by 35%, which is a really devastating blow to our economy here in Ohio and to parents' ability just to get access for their kids. And that's not really surprising, considering that the median hourly wage for childcare workers in Ohio is $13.15 an hour, which is only about an annual salary of $27,000 a year, which is just devastating, I think, for workers that are not only so dedicated to this field and to taking care of Ohio's kids, but also have to put food at their own table. They have to take care of their own families, and they're just not making enough money in order to make the math.
And Catherine, according to your report, when young people can't afford to start a family, people will actually leave for states where they can make more money, get stronger public support. Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, so I can talk about this issue just from personal experience. I am 26. I'm in that period of my life when all of my friends are starting to talk about what's actually realistic for them in terms of starting a family. And when I'm sitting at the dinner table with my friends, we're all talking about childcare and how unaffordable it is to raise a family in Ohio. And people genuinely are looking elsewhere. Since Ohio has the lowest publicly funded childcare eligibility, people are looking to states where maybe that might not be the case, like New Mexico or Maine, that have passed these really comprehensive, high availability childcare policies just in the last couple of years. Because if you are someone who is making the median income in Ohio, which is $65,000 a year for a household, you can't afford publicly funded childcare. It's just not realistic for you and your family. My co-author and I found that a family would have to make about $250,000 a year to afford care for an infant and a toddler at the average childcare center. So in other words, it would take the typical Ohio family about 3 years and 9 months to have enough income just to afford 1 year of childcare in Ohio for two kids. And so with those numbers and that expense, that can definitely push people out of our state.
So, Nancy, all these data points and all this information and kind of raising the alarm of child care shortages and needs, I'm sure, is nothing new for you. Is it refreshing to hear it talked about from, let's say, the Chamber of Commerce and to have, you know, organizations like Policy Matters Ohio, you know, write exhaustively about what the data is showing? And I know that you're going to be having a forum tomorrow kind of speaking to all of this.
Absolutely. About a year and a half ago, I was on this very show with a couple other providers in childcare, talking about the issue, raising the alarm of what we saw was coming. And I am so happy for my colleagues and folks across the state that have joined us in educating our legislators and educating the average individual on the importance of childcare, the importance of quality childcare and affordability. So, yes, thank you so much to the Ohio Chambers. Thank you so much to Policy Matters and all others that have raised the alarm. I also want to raise one issue, that the priority here, if we really want to begin to fix our child care system, well, one I want to say there is incredible quality right now in our community, and I want to thank the providers for that. But let's be honest, earning $13, $14 an hour for having a certificate for child care, or $16, $17 an hour with a BA, with a college degree, and earning $17 an hour, that makes it very hard for our child care centers to hire
and retain
that talent. So for us, priority number one is to really have a good, hard conversation about wages and how to increase those wages so we can continue to have quality child care in our child care centers and homes.
So how do you do that?
Well, I think that conversations like this, we have education and advocacy from our guests that are with us that we appreciate. I think that there's a lot of solutions in other states that we need to take a look at, things from child care credit, tax credits, to greater investments both from public and private sectors. So I think it's time to have that other conversation of taking a look at different models across the nation and then bringing them to Ohio, figuring out what's going to work in Ohio.
So, Dave, you run this network of child care centers. How are you doing post-pandemic? And are you facing the same struggles that, you know, we're hearing about on a broader scope?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the pandemic has been very, very difficult for the whole community, the whole child care community, with, you know, all the lower numbers and all those type of things. Child care is much like, if you want to imagine, a hotel. You know, you need to rent out a certain amount of rooms in your hotel to, you know, to be able to make ends meet. And child care centers, in general, it's around about a 90% enrollment, you know, versus your capacity. Horizons right now is just a little bit over 80% of our enrollment, which is actually a lot higher than a lot of other of my colleagues around the state. Mm-hmm. And the reason we're still here is because of the amount of money that was put in the ARPA dollars and the PPP dollars to keep us afloat. Now that we're coming out of the pandemic and those dollars are drying up and will be dried up totally by September this year, we have to get to that sustainable level. We have to get enrollment up.
Yeah.
And as Nancy's saying, you know, the what's really holding us back on enrollment is staffing with the right people. You know, we have to be very selective. It's very interesting. Unfortunately, the wages that are discussed here are very much in line with fast food or Walmart or whatever. The challenge with us, though, is you can't just walk into a childcare center and say, "Hi, I'm here to work today." You know, you have to go through background checks. You have to go through in-service training. You have to go through orientation. You need child abuse training before you step in the classroom. So all those things have to happen. And, you know, compared to a job at Walmart where you just walk in and start the next day. So as far as getting people into the programs is very difficult. And then, of course, making sure you're getting the right people. You know, these children are very precious to us. They're our most precious resource we have. We have to make sure we're putting the right people in those classrooms. And so staffing and sustainability are the big issues. And it's like one or the other, chicken or egg. How do we get wages up so we can increase our staffing, and how do we become more sustainable and get our enrollment up at the same time? So it's a big challenge.
How important has public funding been for your child care centers?
Oh, it's been absolutely important. You know, the business model for child care doesn't really work.
Right.
And for a lot of the things we've been discussing. And so you need to have some kind of subsidy or some kind of outside help if you really want to have a quality program. Our organization is very dedicated to low moderate income families. We're in areas that were formerly quality childcare deserts, maybe not childcare deserts, but quality childcare deserts. And you know, those type of settings, it's totally dependent on those outside funding, whether it's philanthropic or government.
Nancy?
And I just wanted to add for that individual that's listening right now who doesn't have children and may never have children, why should they care?
Sure.
And let's remind them that, one, quality child care prepares a child to be successful in kindergarten, be successful in school. It allows parents to go back to work, and it provides much needed workforce to the many companies that we are trying to attract to Ohio. So it benefits the community. There is a public good here. And for every dollar that we invest in childcare, there's a return on investment of anywhere between $9 to $13. There have been many, many research reports on this. A child that goes to quality childcare is more apt to graduate high school, more apt to go to college, less likely to need public assistance, and less likely to end up in prison. We know this. We've known it for at least 15, 20 years. And so I would tell our listeners, this is a worthwhile investment, and I would hope that you would help us get the word out.
And it's an everyone issue, as you're saying. Steve, I want to ask you quickly. You talked about the governor potentially making having some exciting news. In your mind, does this absolutely require the involvement of our public officials?
I think it involves the public officials in two ways. One is about the public assistance that we just talked about. The other is we look at rural childcare deserts. 60% of rural inhabitants live in a childcare desert. We need to look at how we empower in-home daycares, because the big childcare centers aren't going to happen in places like Ripley, Ohio, where I grew up with 2,500 people. We do need to make in-home care work better. You know, I want to talk about a group called Wonder Schools that's involved across the country in building that entrepreneurship. In Michigan alone, they've helped launch 75 childcare centers across the state in areas where there were greatest need, mostly in rural areas. So I think that's the other piece. And we're all for the childcare centers and want to help support those. They're just not going to locate in the rural areas. And we have to solve this problem for urban, suburban, and rural areas. And so those are the two pieces of public policy that we think need to change, is more public support for the child care centers, and then encouraging and supporting entrepreneurship in the rural areas for in-home childcare.
And Steve, quickly, what are some of the jobs and companies that you're talking about when you say there is this mass amount of jobs, you know, waiting to be filled, and for Ohio's economy to be actualized and to flourish, they need to be filled?
Well, you know, an example, a simple example is we have more open positions in Ohio than we have people on unemployment. So even if all those people were qualified for those jobs, and the big reason we have unemployed people right now is they don't have the skills for the jobs that are open. The other thing is we don't have people entering the workforce because, for example, sometimes families can't get childcare, so one of the parents has to stay home. And so that results in less participation in our workforce. And we did a study last year that we think it could be a full 1 point increase in workforce participation by just making more affordable, available childcare. We could go, you know, that's so our workforce is about 550,000 people. That would be just a 1% movement helps move us forward and can help make sure that, you know, Ohio employers get thousands of jobs filled that they need filled.
Joel from Akron wrote in saying, my wife and I have three young children. Our mortgage is 6% of our take-home income. Childcare is 31%. Childcare has been our number one expense for years now, and I know that resonates with a lot of parents and families out there. Catherine, your data has shown to as much. Your data's also spoken to the fact of the need for state governments to do something in order to alleviate the situation.
Yeah, so what we know about childcare is that childcare just isn't an industry where the free market is going to fix it. The free market does not care about the quality of education for our kids and their safety. That's really the job of the government. And what Ali Smith and I found when we were writing our paper is that Ohio's childcare crisis is just primarily an investment issue, and that the state legislature really has to take responsibility for investing in this issue, particularly in the next budget cycle. The difference between states with strong childcare infrastructure, because that's what childcare is, it's infrastructure. The difference is primarily investment. And so you can see that states make purposeful, consistent investment in childcare and that have been matched to inflation that are directly putting money in the pockets of workers and small businesses. Those are the states that have strong childcare and accessible childcare for everyone. And so it's really the responsibility of our state legislature to continue to invest in this problem. And that they are the ones in the situation that really have the power to turn the market around in Ohio.
And Catherine, I'm curious. So we're talking about centers and childcare facilities that might get reimbursement from the state. What about those other childcare centers or daycares that aren't getting any sort of reimbursement? Is there any sort of trickle-down effect that happens if you're helping, you know, certain childcare centers that the whole industry does better?
So what we know, you know, across the board is that the government's role in situations like this can be to set a baseline standard for a market. And so in this situation, by setting quality childcare rates that are good paying jobs where workers are supported in the public market, that often spreads to the private pay market. You know, often the government is the one setting the standards across the board. And so by setting good, strong standards for childcare all over Ohio and actually investing in that, that will make the public market competitive with the private market, which will eventually help workers everywhere. And so we know that the government has a role to play here, and that is setting strong standards for the market that everyone can benefit from in the future.
And Nancy, you know, we're talking on a state level, but I also know that Starting Point has been working with the city and county in allocation of funds to help the childcare industry in our area.
Absolutely. Cuyahoga County has been really a huge supporter of early child care education for decades. They have a department dedicated to that, Invest in Children. They are have been funding universal pre-K in the county for over 10 years, which provides funding for our child care center so that they can provide excellence. And they provide scholarships for parents as well. And then most recently, our city made a huge investment in providing bonus and retention dollars to help stabilize the workforce, and also scholarships for our families. So it's really wonderful to have the support of the city and the county because they also have seen the data. They also understand the importance of providing quality childcare, having accessible to the families, and I think that it does help build our economy and stabilize the economy as well. So they have been very supportive.
And let's talk about, and it seems somewhat novel because I haven't certainly heard about it in my own private experience, but employers and the people hiring workers, their involvement in being supportive when it comes to the need for probably, you know, a good swath of their employees who need childcare. Dave, you've heard about other states or other companies that'll actually chip into their employees' childcare costs?
Sure. And there's a share program called TriShare, which is in a couple of the surrounding states around Ohio, where there is a share type thing where maybe a third of the cost is paid for. I'm talking about individual tuition by an employer, a third by the employee, and then a third by the state. Now the jury's still out on some of these programs. The one in Kentucky is a lot more successful because it doesn't have a mandatory contribution level. Michigan requires that a full third is paid for by the employer, and there's a very low take-up rate with that program because of that. It's a large commitment for an employer, and of course the government, the states are setting aside the dollars for the other pieces. You know, the other area that's really important, I think, as far as looking at policy, and it's something we tried to get in the budget last time, and Governor DeWine backed, was providing scholarships for child care, people that work in the child care field. Kind of like, you know, like if you work at a college, your kid gets to go to the college for free.
Sure.
The same type of thing. And that, of course, helps a lot to get more workforce, and also, you know, provides you're dealing with a lot of moms, you know, that sort of are obviously more involved with children.
Sure, of course.
You know, takes it less train up, that type of thing. You know, but right now a lot of centers, including Horizons, we do provide some subsidies to our employees to use Horizons for their childcare needs, but that's out of our general fund, which is already very, very overtaxed.
Now, Steve, have you heard of corporations or companies in Ohio that are contributing to the cost of some of their employees' childcare needs? Steve?
Yes, sorry, absolutely. There are a bunch of companies that are both providing. The bigger companies will set up an in the office or on their campus childcare. For example, the Intel site that's being built, it looks like they're going to build a childcare facility right there, and they're going to subsidize it.
Wow.
The other advice I would give to any of your listeners is take advantage of flexible spending accounts. You can put up to $5,000. Almost every employer will allow this. You can put up to $5,000 of pre-tax dollars in a childcare account. That will make your dollars leverage much further. Let's say you're in the 20% tax bracket. You know, every dollar you put in gives you basically $1.20 in buying power compared to what you'd have in after-tax dollars. So everybody should max out their flexible spending account if they have kids in daycare. But a lot of companies will also support it, usually the bigger employers.
Right.
And, you know, there are a lot of child care centers that are doing exactly what the last speaker just said. One of our members, the Children's Discovery Center, which is out of Toledo, gives a 60% grant to their workers for childcare costs. So if it increases how far their wages go, because, you know, if I've got kids and I've two kids and I'm in they're in childcare and I choose to work in a childcare facility, when I only pay 40% of the cost for their childcare, my wages look like they're going a lot further. And Kentucky has a program that authorizes that at 100% paid for by state dollars. We tried to get it in Ohio law. We supported it. The governor supported it. Unfortunately, it didn't make it in the final version of the budget, in the operating budget last year, and we're going to go back at it for sure next year.
Steve, we have 30 seconds to answer this, but interesting that the Intel semiconductor chip plant might have a child care center on it. I mean, obviously seeing some sort of payoff to making sure that the types of workers they need can just drop off their baby or toddler to a center at work before they go in for the day.
We're seeing a lot of big employers do that. There's a lot of interest in larger employers doing that and even subsidizing the cost somewhat.
Steve Stivers with the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, Catherine Poe with Policy Matters Ohio, Nancy Mendez with Starting Point, and Dave Smith with Horizon Education Centers. Great conversation. I thank all of you for participating today.
Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Time now for a quick break. On the other side, my conversation with a population demographer who researches how population trends shape our world. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. As the world nears a population of 8 billion people, political demographer Jennifer Shuba sees a great divide as our current human story. And that's the great divide between richer and poorer countries in all three areas of population, which are fertility, mortality, and migration. She writes that on average, 240 babies are born every minute in the world's least developed countries, whereas 25 are born per minute in the most developed ones. And some of the world's youngest countries are also the most autocratic and poor. Shuba, in her book, 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World, asks the question, how can we use the 8 billion people we have on the planet today to shape the world we want tomorrow? I recently spoke with Shuba about population growth and her new book. Dr. Jennifer Shuba, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you so much.
Jennifer, you've taught at Rhodes College in Memphis. You've worked as a consultant to the U.S. Office of the Secretary of Defense, written for The Atlantic, The Washington Post. You're really a leading thinking and researcher when it comes to studying demographics and population. So I am curious, what put you on this path?
Well, I kind of came at it from the environmental perspective first. That's kind of the home of population research when I was younger, and I was interested in those issues and thinking about how we use resources and the balance between the number of us and the types of resources we use and what's available to us. And so I really distinctly remember being in college when world population hit 6 billion people. And my professor making a really big deal of that, saying that there were too many people on the planet. And that stuck with me. And I think that plus some courses on migration, some courses on gender studies, all kind of coalesced for me. And I was also studying Japan at the time, that population was a really powerful force in so many realms of our society, our economy, and politics.
So your professor was referencing 6 billion being too many, and now we are approaching Earth's 8 billionth person being born. As simply as you can, why is it more important than ever for us to study and care about population growth?
Well, I noticed, you know, I was actually already a professor when we hit 7 billion, and I was telling a really different story than my professor had told at 6 billion. And I think that story has only gotten more complicated as we've added an additional billion, which is that it's not straightforward. So what we have seen happen as this last couple of billion people have hit is that even though there are more and more people on the planet, the rate at which we're adding people is really slowing. So the conversation about population can't just be one about there being too many people. Instead, you know, we've got over 30 countries with shrinking populations. So there's a really huge variety of population issues around the world. And people are the foundation of every society, right? They're our workers and our soldiers. And so we have to understand how many of us there are and where we are and who we are in order to get a better understanding of our world generally.
So do you think there are too many people on the planet?
I don't. No, I think that it's a really the wrong way to look at it, because if we are still saying there are too many people, but two out of three people on the planet live somewhere with low birth rates, then what we're really saying is that there are just too many people in the very, very few parts of the world where there still have high birth rates. And that's complicated, because those are actually the people on Earth who consume the least, whereas we, I mean, me in particular, right? I mean, probably you as well. Oh, I don't want to point a finger, but we consume a lot, right? We're out there, you know, our eating patterns, our, all the lights on in our houses and devices and travel and all of these things. And so to say that it's about birth rates more than about our behavior, I think is really problematic.
And I know that you've also tried to pivot from talking about population being a problem, and you mentioned it yourself, but let's talk about consumption as the issue that our kind of global society is dealing with.
Yes, and I think it's even more important going forward that we focus on that, and actually not even as much on the wealthiest countries in the world, because a country like India, it surprises most people to learn that they have below replacement births. So, you know, a fertility rate of two roughly replaces, you know, a mother and a father. So that's considered replacement level. India's already below that. And this is a country we think of as having a really booming population. So it's not, if we just think about, oh, well, perhaps family planning will, you know, dilute India's impact on the environment, that'd be the wrong way of thinking, because they've already got that part. Instead, we have to think about rising standards of living. And so obviously, you know, they should have rising standards of living. You know, we would want people to be able to pull out of poverty and to flourish. But as people do so worldwide, of course, they have a bigger impact on the planet. And so I think we're at this really tough point where, you know, there are probably 6 of our 8 billion people, 6 billion, who we expect, if everything goes well, to have rising standards of living over the next few decades. But what that's going to do, of course, is have a bigger planetary impact. And by planetary, let's not talk about Earth as a whole, but let's think about their communities. So, you know, the people in India, for example, want to have clean water and a clean environment so that they can flourish the best as possible. So we have to really start thinking about how we consume and helping people to be able to live better quality lives, which would include letting them live in a clean environment.
So I'm curious, how do you view the role of population growth and the boom that we've seen over the past 200 years with the issue of climate change?
Well, certainly it's mattered. Yes. I mean, I would never, just because I don't want to really perpetuate the overpopulation rhetoric now, of course it has mattered. You know, more of us, there are rising standards of living, and our reliance on technologies that are really fueled by fossil fuels has led to climate change. And so I think where we might make a mistake is assuming that if populations in rich countries start shrinking, as they're starting to do, that the environment will just get clean. And that's, again, like, you know, something we want to be cautious about, that it's not going to be an automatic thing. It's something we would have to work towards.
So now, early in the 1800s, we hit a billion people. And then it took less than 250 years to approach 8 billion people. What do you think the biggest stressors have been because of that really rapid growth? Do you think it's food production, human migration, the need for labor across the planet?
Well, generally speaking, it's been great. So what we've added an entire extra life to life expectancy over this time. So, you know, I think there's a tendency to focus on the negative. And of course, if you're a biologist, or, you know, I taught environmental politics for 15 years, if you are Earth focused and that's your center, then all you're seeing is the impact on the planet. And I don't want to take that away, but if you're human centered, it is a story of absolute flourishing. There's inequality built in there, of course, but people are healthier. Infectious diseases are no longer the number one killer. Non-communicable diseases are. Life expectancy is longer. And so really we need to think about it as it has been a positive story for us.
A success story. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to ask about migration and immigration, because currently it's a huge part of our national discourse. It's a huge part of our elections that are going on, our presidential election, and will continue to be front and center for the next 6 months. So do you think immigration into North America, into the U.S. really is a disruptor, or are politicians using this as a political ploy?
I always say migration is a political issue, not a demographic one. And I think that's absolutely the case because, you know, we do have borders in our societies today. These matter. And I think politicians don't have an incentive to fix the migration system in a way that would benefit the migrants and would benefit the communities. Instead, they seem to get a lot of political oxygen from letting the situation be one that can kind of harm everybody. And that's part of the way our system is set up. In a lot of democracies, there's, you know, if you think about it being a right and a left side of the political spectrum, there's groups on the right that want more immigration, and there's groups on the right that want less. There's groups on the left that want more immigration and that want less immigration. And so it doesn't come down neatly in a way that makes for easy policymaking.
So how, in fact, damaging do you think these alarmist tones, as you've characterized them as, about immigrants and really the vilification of immigrants by some in our society, how damaging is that?
Well, I'm not sure that it ends up benefiting anyone because, you know, we have a system in the U.S. where I talk to people all the time who have huge workforce shortages everywhere from, you know, needing tradespeople to work on plumbing in their hotel all the way up to needing IT managers to work on hotel reservations, for example. And so they have these labor needs that are not being filled domestically, but there's not, I would say, a coherent system at the national level to help them meet those needs. And so it's like we have two things happening at once and have for a long time in the society: a need for labor, no way to fill it, but then also concerns about the identity shifts that happen when you do bring migrants in. So that people, when they move their religion, they remove their politics, they move everything. And so it's not just in the U.S., it's everywhere that's dealing with this. You know, anytime there's change, that's always difficult for people. And the fact that there's not people at the national level in policymaking who seem to want to have a very rational policy around it, it's not helping anyone.
And so, I mean, are there any recommendations that you can make or thoughts on how, you know, the discourse should be framed?
I think, you know, more than anything, it's just making sure that there's adequate resources for people to deal with population changes. You know, I try to stay as agnostic as I can about the migration issue because it's really different in each community. It's really different at each for each country. But we do know a lot of times that, you know, maybe a specific community will have a huge influx of people who do not speak English, but without the resources in the schools to help the schools. Well, that doesn't benefit the children who've come in or their families or the children who are there or their families. So I think it's just making sure that your policy is really comprehensive and has adequate resources to help deal with all of the different parts of people moving.
So we hear about the silver tsunami talked about a lot, the aging population in the United States, here in Ohio happening. Centenarians, you reference, are the fastest growing age group. Is that in the world? Tell me how that is impacting, you know, our global society, is to watch the population age and their lifespans increase.
Well, generally, it should be a good thing, right? Our goal is to live longer and live longer, healthier lives. But I think the stress comes from when the systems that we're within have not changed. And so those systems, for example, include retirement. You know, if you're living a really long time and hopefully in good health, but you have exited the workforce in your early 60s, then that kind of puts a strain on your personal finances. Or if you're taking from a larger pile of money, you know, at the national level, puts a strain on those finances. So those old systems don't fit. There's generally inadequate care systems
We have people who are, you know, of adult ages end up taking care of aging parents while they also need to work, but with inadequate resources for that as well. So it's really, we're at this point where we have to rethink how to support people in their caregiving. And as I travel around the country and talk to different groups, I often learn about stresses, even in things all the way down to zoning. Like, I you know, and I would wonder how it is in, you know, think about your own county. Are multi-generational homes even allowed, for example? And if the answer is no, then you can end up exacerbating the problem. So it's really thinking through these systems at a really micro level and how best to support people.
Okay, I'm curious. The coronavirus pandemic impacted the research that you were doing for this book. How?
Well, in some ways, I mean, it impacted my research in the sense that I ended up at home with two little kids trying to write and finish a book.
Certainly.
I mean, that was the big part. You know, for the most part, we've kind of learned that the pandemic just like cranked up the volume on trends that were already happening. So not so much that it changed the trajectory of those trends. So it's like it shines a light on where there are already weaknesses. In the United States, we knew that there are significant issues with our health system and our health ourselves. Like, we do not, compared to what we think of as peer countries, we are much less healthy. And so I think the pandemic ends up shining a light on that. For example, we think about health span rather than lifespan. So think about the number of years you live healthy. The U.S. peers are Mexico, China, and Russia. This is like pre-pandemic. The U.S. peers are not, you know, Italy, Greece, Spain. And so you already have these issues, they just become much more highlighted when there's a big stress like COVID.
So you mentioned Russia. My understanding is that that's one of the countries that is, you know, on the precipice of or already experiencing pressures when it comes to population decline.
Yes, yes, and has been for a while. Yes.
So what are the effects on the Russian society when it's dealing with that?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing in the kind of national security circles that I run around in. Early on, you know, maybe 20 years ago, there was an assumption that with Russia's population struggles, that would lead the country to be more peaceful, that they just wouldn't be able to afford to be aggressive, literally, like the national budget, or thinking in terms of number of soldiers. And of course, we have seen that is absolutely not true, that because of their political system with one person really in charge and being the decision maker, they can overcome that in the sense that the population will really struggle, but Putin will pursue whatever national security goals he has. And right. So I think the short answer to your question is really complicated, or it doesn't affect them the way that we thought that it would. I mean, I never thought that way anyway, because it matters if you're a democracy or a non-democracy. You know, China's population is also shrinking already, and yet I wouldn't anticipate over the next 20 years for China to become a more peaceful country just because of that.
Interesting. Now, you are coming to the Cleveland Council on World Affairs. So when you speak at a place like that, what do you hope to convey to an audience? And are there specific types of questions that you like fielding from the crowd?
Well, I love to, number one, do some myth busting, because I think everybody knows a little bit about population, but it has really changed. I mean, it's changed in my adult life, our trends. So one of the things I always want to accomplish is helping people understand how those trends have changed. If you grew up at a time when there was a huge booming population worldwide, a lot of people are surprised to see how slow it has gotten. I also like for people to understand how important politics is, that it's demography is not destiny, but the politics really matters. And then I love to get questions that kind of talk about whatever the issues are in a particular community, because it's a great opportunity for me to learn. My next book that I'm working on now, and, you know, it'll take me a couple years, is much more at the micro level about how different industries are facing workforce issues. It's about caregiving and retirement. And so I always love learning from people how they're dealing with these issues in their own society or not dealing with them. As much as this is, we talk about global population, it's just an aggregate of individual decisions. And so I think the community level is where the really important conversations happen.
And certainly in Northeast Ohio, on our show, we have a lot of conversations about the growth of our region and the history of population decline and trying to make sure that there's enough people locally or from people coming to the region to fill the jobs that we have in the thousands out there. So pretty relevant conversation.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that is where the conversation in the U.S. really needs to start, being because the reason the U.S. population is growing is because of immigration. You know, we've got below replacement fertility rates. Women have on average about 1.6 children in their lifetimes. That means that states and communities are competing with each other for the same person. And so there'll be winners and there'll be losers. And I think that there have always been regions, of course, that have kind of struggled with this, thinking in terms of industries that have come and gone. But it's just going to get bigger and bigger as an issue over the next 20, 30, 40 years. And so I think there's perhaps a lot that we can learn from communities that have dealt with this in the past.
Dr. Jennifer Shuba, author of 8 Billion and Counting, How Sex, Death, and Migration Shape Our World. She is speaking at the Cleveland Council on World Affairs tonight at 5:30. Her lecture is titled Global Population, Sorting Fact from Fiction. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter now, X at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_ or on Instagram at @JennyHamillIdeaStream. Yesterday, we got feedback from Northeast Ohio residents on their experience viewing the total solar eclipse. Nancy said via email, "It was amazing to see so many people come together to watch the eclipse. All my neighbors out on their lawns, everybody cheering together. My sister-in-law said if we could only figure out a way to make this kind of community sharing and into a more unifying atmosphere in our country." Hear, hear. Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Nancy. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we're going to discuss the search for a new Akron police chief and why some Black elected leaders say they're not happy with the process. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for listening. I'll speak with you again tomorrow.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rood, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Auble provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast, and our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.